Right. So the discourse which the previous Rebbe, which the sixth Rebbe had arranged to be studied on the 10th of Shvat, was actually part of a series of four discourses, and each called a ma'amarim, four ma'amarim. And each of these discourses had five chapters, so that's 20 chapters altogether. Now, that original discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, let me just see what it's blurred for some reason. It's blurred because of something. Let me just change the. I know why this is. Here we are. It's to do with the video. Right. Okay. So that should be. Yeah. So this Bossi Legani, you see, this book, it's not very long. It's in English, and it's even available online, I believe, the whole thing. This is a translation of the original 20 chapters of that discourse. Now, when the sixth Rebbe passed away, so there's then the seventh Rebbe, his son-in-law. And there was, for a time, the seventh Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, said, we have a Rebbe, we don't need anyone else, the previous Rebbe is our Rebbe. But people pressed him, we need someone, you are the right person to lead us. And so, a year later, on the first Yahrzeit, he accepted the position of being Rebbe, and he did that by saying a discourse relating to this discourse. And it focused on the first chapter of the 20 chapters. And the next year, that was 1951, the next year, 1952, he said a discourse relating to the second chapter. And so it went on for 20 years. And then when he'd completed it, he began again at the beginning. So in 1971, he began again from the beginning of this discourse. And so there are two books, right? The blue one is the first 20 years, and the brown one is the second 20 years. And these are quite substantial books in Hebrew, which have got the discourses of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, of the seventh Rebbe, discussing this discourse of the previous Rebbe. So in other words, because the Rebbe had left this discourse, in fact, it was a very remarkable discourse anyway, and the Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, had first recited that discourse in 1923, and then he said it again in 1939, and then he said it, then he issued it for study in 1950. So throughout his life as Rebbe, he became Rebbe in 1920. So throughout his life as Rebbe, this discourse was something very significant. And it's a very significant teaching for us concerning a way of understanding the whole nature of existence, the purpose of creation. And it's a very beautiful discourse. Now, so the focus of the discourse, which we're going to be looking at, it's a very long discourse, and the main focus is on the 12th chapter, because that corresponds with this year. It's like the 12th year of the, is it the fourth cycle, Rebbe Lu? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's the 12th chapter of the fourth cycle. And the whole thing is fascinating. And it gives a perspective on the meaning of life in a very, very important way. And so therefore, it's something that I believe it is very appropriate for us to study, even though, in a sense, it is very advanced mystical teaching. So I'm going to play the melody of the Mima, the Mima melody. It is something very, very special. Rabbi Lou, would you like to add anything?
Well, as you go, I was actually here. It was like next week, 60 years. The advanced mystical teaching, the point is that what you're going to speak about, the purpose of creation, and how is it is handed over to leaders, but mainly to the normal, simple people to do with dedication. It's a struggle because it's trying to combine and to reveal the spiritual in the physical world. And it's a war. We are soldiers in an army in that war. And there are two types of wars. There's one type of a war where a king wants to or has to expand or to fight about something. There's a second type, which is a war which political and diplomatic consideration before entering into it. And then there's a war, which is an ultimate war, in order to, there's an enemy that's fighting, and you have to vanquish that enemy. And that second type of war has no limits. And therefore, a king who has treasures that are hidden for many generations, which are not seen by anybody, let alone used, will be taken and splurged and used however necessary, these greatest, deepest treasures. So the Rebbe says that this Mima, which we're going to do today, the 12th chapter begins to tell us what the great treasure is. That's basically why it's talking about such high. The next couple of chapters in the original discourse are about that greatness.
Thank you very much. That's very useful. Thank you. So I'm going to play the melody.
Came over beautifully.
Thank you. Well, one never knows quite with Zoom what one can hear, what one can't. Right, here we have this discourse said in 1962 on the 10th of Shvat. And Rabbi Lou was there. Is that what you said?
Yes, 60 years ago.
Wonderful. Bati legani achoti kala. Right, so here we have, this is a line from the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. And the Song of Songs is a very profound love story. And it's a love story between God and the Jewish people. And so in this love story, the man, you see, the Song of Songs reads as if it's a love story between a man and a woman. And there was a discussion by the sages in the time of the Mishnah, whether that's 2,000 years ago, approximately, there was a discussion whether this is really a holy book. It looks just like a love song between a man and a woman. The man says things to the woman says things to the man. And they thought maybe it's not part of the Bible at all. The Bible is supposed to be all prophecies by prophets, holy writing. So Rabbi Akiva, who was a great mystic, Rabbi Akiva said, all the books of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, are holy. And the Song of Songs is holy of holies, is particularly holy, because it speaks about this special spiritual relationship of the divine with the individual or with the Jewish people as a whole. Now, so let's take this verse and understand it. Bati legani, I have come into my garden, achoti kala, my sister, my bride. So that's a very beautiful expression. God says to the Jewish people, I have come into my garden and my sister, my bride, that's how he's terming the people, that's how he calls them. Now, the Midrash discusses this on the Song of Songs, like on the whole Torah and all the other books of the Torah, there are Midrashim, there are explanations by the sages. So famous explanations. And so the Midrash says about this, that this actually refers to the moment that the sanctuary was built at the foot of Mount Sinai, and in the sanctuary dwelled the Shekhinah, the divine presence. And so Moses took the Jewish people out of Egypt. They then came to Mount Sinai. They got the Torah. And when they had the Torah, eventually they made the sanctuary. And in the sanctuary was revealed the divine presence, the Shekhinah. So that was a very remarkable event of the presence, the divine presence entering the sanctuary. And here it explains the Midrash, which is being quoted by this discourse, explains why it is so significant. Umavaya Bal Hayilula and Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the sixth Rebbe, explains Al Yesod Mama HaMidrash, based on the Midrash, Legani Lignuni. The words, I've come to my garden, can be related to another word, Gnuni. Gnuni, it's like the word Genesis, like the beginning, to my beginning. It also means a bridal chamber. I've come back to my special place where I was at the beginning. Lamakom shahaya ikari b'tchila, the place where I was at the beginning. De'ikar shchina b'tachtonim hayta. Because when we think back to the beginning of the Torah, the Garden of Eden, and Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, were in the Garden of Eden. Together with them was the divine presence. And the essence of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, was in the Garden of Eden with them. Now that's actually the way that existence should be. There should be a realm, which is the physical realm, like our physical realm. And in that physical realm, there should be human beings like Adam and Eve. And with them, there should be the divine presence, the Shekhinah. That's really the goal of creation, that there should be a realm which is batachtonim, in the lower world, not in a world of angels, but in a world of physicality and physical people. And in that realm should be the divine presence. And that's really the goal. The only thing is what happened in the Garden of Eden. Elo sha'al yedei ha-chataim, but through the sins that people did, silku et ha-shekhinah, they made the Shekhinah remove itself, milamata lamaila, from below to above. The first sin was eating from the tree of knowledge. The second sin was Cain killing Abel. And then there were further sins. And the Midrash actually counts out seven sins, seven periods of sin. And as a result of that, the divine presence retreated further and further away from the world. Va'achakach, but after that, amdu shivat tzadikim, there came seven tzadikim, seven righteous men. And of course, each one had a wife. Now, the purpose of a righteous man is to bring the divine into the world and reveal the divine in the world. That's really what righteousness is. He's not righteous just that he should be rewarded by God, or she should be rewarded by God. He's righteous in order to reveal God in the world. And so there arose seven tzaddikim. The first of them was Abraham. Abraham began the process. This is what the Midrash says, but it's here put in brief. He began bringing the divine presence back towards the world. After him came his son, Isaac, Yitzchak. That's two. And after Yitzchak came Jacob, that's three. And then Jacob's sons, there was one son who was particularly spiritual, is Levi. He's the ancestor of the Levites, the Kohanim. And Levi's oldest son was Kahat. And Kahat's oldest son was Amram. And Amram's son, does anyone know who Amram's son was?
Moses.
That's right, Moses. Thank you.
Very good.
He was the seventh, right? So we have these, so the achakach amdu shiva tzadikim, then there were seven tzadikim, v'himshichu et hashkina milamayla lamata, they drew the divine presence from above to below, ad Moshe Rabbeinu, till Moses, our teacher, roe neman shel kol Yisrael, the faithful shepherd of the whole Jewish people. That's a very beautiful expression, the faithful shepherd. One way of understanding that he's the faithful shepherd is that he's a very reliable leader of the Jewish people. Another way of understanding it, which the Rebbe talks about in a different discourse, is that the purpose of Moshe Rabbeinu is to reveal a deeper level of emunah in God, a deeper level of faith in God in each individual. And so he is pasturing the faith of the individual Jew and of the Jewish people as a whole. And Moses, Shehu Hashvi, he is the seventh. And another Midrash tells us, V'chol Hashviin Chavivin, all sevenths are precious, like the Shabbat day is the seventh, and other things which are seven. Matisyahu, did you want to say something? No. So he, Moshe, being the seventh, had a special spiritual power. Shehimshech et hashchinah, and he drew down the divine presence. Merakia harishon la'aretz, from the first firmament. That means going down. That was the seventh or sixth firmament higher up, and then coming down, and then from the first firmament coming down la'aretz to earth itself, back to the world, by the Shekhinah being revealed on Mount Sinai, you could say, and later in the Holy of Holies, in the sanctuary that they built, the temple, the prototype of the temple that they built at Mount Sinai, and then they carried it through the desert. And when they reached the land of Israel after 40 years, they put it up in various places, and eventually it came to Jerusalem, and that became, then they built, King Solomon built a temple made of stone, and that became the temple in Jerusalem. And there is the divine presence. Shezel tachlit ha'inyan, that's the real goal of the idea, sheyedira lo yidbarach betachtonim, that there should be a dwelling for God in the lower world. Now there's another midrash which says this is the purpose of creation, that the divine should dwell in the lower world. By lower world, it means a world where God could easily be concealed, as our world, due to the concealment of godliness, that gives a possibility of people doing immoral things and crime and war and also disease and all kinds of negative things are possible because our world is a lower world where God is hidden. But nonetheless, in this world, the goal is to reveal the divine. And we, the Jewish people, with our Torah, we are trying to reveal the divine in our homes and in daily life. And that is the task that we are trying to do on behalf of the whole world, and that it will take off in such a way that there will be revealed the divine presence, and the whole world will be transformed into people who recognize God and they see God, and then there will be no more war and no more crime and no more immorality. And even there will be no more disease. There will be nothing negative. Everything will become positive. And that is the time of Mashiach. And ultimately, even the further level of the time of the revival of the dead. Now, Ach Kadesh Inyan Zehir Bekviot, in order that this should be in a fixed way, Hine Miyad La'achere Hamshachat Hashkina Merekia Rishon La'aretz, immediately after drawing the divine presence down into the world at the giving of the Torah, then came the command, Va'asuli Mikdash. They should make for me, the Jewish people, should make for me a sanctuary, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell in them. Now, it doesn't say I will dwell in it. It says I will dwell in them, because God dwells inside every individual. And inside every individual is a sanctuary for God. So that is an incredible idea, that there is a sanctuary for God inside the heart of every individual. The Be'inyan HaMishkan, now concerning this sanctuary, which is the prototype of the temple, it says, Va'asita et hakhashim la'mishkan, you should make the planks for the sanctuary, and they are made of atzei shittim omdim, and they're made of planks of cedar wood standing up. And it explains, sha'otiot keresh, the letters of the word plank, morim al ofen ha'avodah, they indicate the kind of service of God we have to do. Because keresh, you can rearrange the letters of the word keresh. Keresh means plank, a sacred plank to put in the sanctuary. But can someone tell me another arrangement of those words, of those letters? What is another word that can be formed with those three letters?
Sheker as well.
Negative. That's quite right. Sheker, falsehood. Our service of God means taking the falsehood of the world and transforming it into something holy. It is a process of rearranging things. So there are things which are false, the way that they are normally thought about and treated. But then we have the power, the spiritual power, to rearrange those letters and make them, instead of sheker, which is shin kufresh, it becomes keresh, a plank of the sanctuary. Now, it says about these planks is that they're made of atzei shittim. Now, the word shittim, I translated it cedar wood, some people translated acacia wood, but it relates to a word, shtut. The goal of the service is sheyu atzei shittim, they should be planks of cedar wood, acacia wood, shtut, folly, dikdusha, of holiness. Now, this is a very, very remarkable concept, which I'm going to stop sharing for a moment just to share a memory, which must be something like 1969, I would imagine, or maybe 1970. When I was a student in Hillel, and I was a student at UCL, University College, and I went to a talk that Rabbi Shmuel Lu, who's here, he had come either to Hillel House or to the University College itself, which is just nearby. Now they've knocked down that Hillel House, or they do something else with it. But he was there, and he gave a talk on this concept, as I remember it. And it's the idea that there are two kinds of folly. Shtut is folly, yes? You're living in Israel, Hannah. You know, if someone does something silly, you say, shtut. Yes? Yeah. It's something stupid. So there are two kinds of shtut. There, you see, there's a line of seichel, a line of rationality. And shtut, the normal kind of shtut, stupid folly, is something lower than the line of rationality. But there is another kind of shtut. And that is the shtut, the folly, which goes higher than the line. Shtut dikdusha, the folly of holiness. Now, the folly of holiness means a person going beyond reason in order to serve Hashem in a way which goes beyond ordinary understanding, ordinary rationality. Yeah. And by doing that, by making that step beyond reason, in some sense, they rescue that which they had done going below reason. And that step beyond reason, that is a transformative dimension. That's reaching God in a very extraordinary way. So if we go back to 1970, and I had read Kierkegaard and his concept of the absurd, I was very fascinated by this idea that Rabbi Lu was talking about. And it was one of the things that I remember as having a very special effect on me. So it's this discourse, and it's that Rabbi Lu. And so if we return to the text, but let me just ask, is there anything that anyone would like to comment at this point?
Just wondered if this... Sorry,
Hold on 1 second, Julian. Yes,
yeah, sure.
The reason for the advance of the exception will be private, according to the tournament director, Craig Tiley. The Australian Open will begin later on this month. That's all for me. I'll now let's get back to Dan. That's mine.
Look, I'm muting everyone, but you can unmute yourself. Right. Now, Agnes, were you going to say something? No. Okay, Julian, what were you going to say?
Thank you. I just wondered if there was any link between this going beyond folly for religious reasons and the prophets and their practices.
That's an interesting point, because the prophets would sometimes do, as it were, irrational things. The prophets were exposed to the divine. The divine influx would flow into the prophets, and you could make a connection there. Yeah, you could make. Anyone else with anything?
May I ask, could it be that David dancing like a fool, was one of the examples of above rationality?
King David?
Yeah, he danced in a very... Michal was laughing at him.
That's an excellent case. Rivka is referring to the scene when King David brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and he was dancing very wildly. And his wife Michal was critical of him. She was the daughter of King Saul, and she said quite a nasty thing to him. Is this how a king behaves in front of the servants and maidservants of the palace, dancing in this wild way? And he says back to her, listen, I will dance wildly for God. Then that's a very good point, Rivka. Yes, certainly that is an example of intense devotion to the divine. All right, so let's go back into the text. You see, what the discourse is doing at this moment, it's going through very quickly 10 chapters, the 10 previous chapters. It's then going to focus more on the 11th, but I think we'll miss that out. We'll just go straight to the 12th. So that's so it's speaking about this. So that is the folly, the shtutik kedusha, the folly of holiness, shezoi avoda shelamayla mitam badat. That is the service which is higher than reason. Sha'al yedei zeh metaknim, and it's through that one puts right et ha-shitim et ha-shtut de-l'umat zeh. One puts right the folly which is negative. K'maymer azal, as the sages say, ein adam choteh, a person would not sin, eile im kein nichnas bo ruach shtut, unless a spirit of folly enters the person. Really, it's completely irrational for anyone to do anything against the Torah. We have a beautiful Torah with the most beautiful teachings, and it is a quite irrational thing for a person to break the laws of the Torah. But we do, people do. Why? Because a spirit of folly enters into them. So the spirit of folly might dress itself up in different ways. The spirit of folly might be a tremendous passion for something which is forbidden, or it might be a way of looking at the world. Oh, we're in the modern world, so therefore these old laws don't apply to us. Whatever it is a spirit of folly. And it's through the fact that the person has a dedication to God, which goes higher than the line, higher than seichel, higher than intellect. Nishlama hakavana, the intention, the divine intention, liyot dira lo yitbarech betachtonim, that God should have a dwelling in the lower world, that is achieved. That is achieved through the fact of going higher than rationality with dedication to God. The fact of a person doing things with total dedication, often risking their life or their safety in different ways, that dedication is something very profound and very important. As it happens, the doctorate that I wrote eventually at the university was on this theme of self-sacrifice. In self-sacrifice for the sanctification of God's name, in the teachings of the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Mittler Rebbe. So this, that might be why I remember this so well, learning this with Rabbi Lou, although at that time I was doing my first degree, I wasn't yet doing the doctorate. Now this, the Avodah Zu, now this service, one second. Let's take it a little bit longer. Now this service, Naaset al bidei b'nei Yisrael, is achieved through the Jewish people, kamavua b'chamer mekomot, as it explained in a number of different sources, and this note 13 gives a Hasidic text which lists different sources, shedavka al yedei b'nei Yisrael, that it's through the Jewish people, Po'alim ha-Torah u-mitzvot et pu'ulatam. The Torah that they study and the mitzvot that they keep have this special spiritual effect. So there we have the idea of the Jewish people being in the world with the Torah and the mitzvot of the Torah. And the purpose of what they are doing is transformative. They are transforming the world by the fact of keeping these mitzvot. And very often, that means doing something beyond rationality. It might seem irrational just keeping a mitzvah, putting on tefillin, that a person might say, you know, what is this to put on tefillin? A man is supposed to put on tefillin every weekday and say the Shema, at least, that it seems like a very a beyond rational action. And nonetheless, that is the, I remember my mother, Aleha Shalom. My grandfather was a chazan. He had come from Poland where someone heard him sing in a synagogue and they said, oh, I can get you a job in London. This was around 1970. And he came to London and they got him a job in the West End of London, in a synagogue in the West End of London. He was a chazan. And they had a house in the West End in Mornington Crescent. And my mother would describe to me how when it came to Sukkot, they would build a sukkah at the end of the garden. For some reason, that was the convenient place. And there they had this hut at the end of the garden, and they would be carrying tureens of soup and the chicken and this and that all the way from the house through the garden to the sukkah. And next door, the English people living next door would look out of the window. What are they doing? Carrying this food through the garden, going to sit in that little hut. What are they doing? So to them, it looked like something very irrational to do. Of course, it's the regular mitzvah of Sukkot, of keeping, having a sukkah, and building a sukkah and eating in it in the sukkah festival. But it could be seen as something which is folly beyond reason. And especially if there are difficulties, this was just the raised eyebrow. Yes, the raised eyebrow, that is a certain kind of mesirut nefesh, that someone, when he looks at you, he raises his eyebrow. Oh, that's very strange. The English are very good at doing this. I'm not sure, Agnes, do the Hungarians have raised eyebrows in the way the English have? You're muted. We can't hear. You need to unmute yourself. Sorry.
I would have thought it might be international.
Yes.
As an expression of surprise or mild disapproval.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, but sometimes it's really a threat to life. And there are people who tried and did keep Jewish teaching despite the tremendous danger involved. In very recent terms, there's the Jews in Soviet Russia Now, Rabbi Liu went several times to Russia at the height of the communist regime, smuggling in things to do with Judaism in order to help the Jews there keep Jewish law and Jewish teachings, even though if they were found out, they could be sent to prison or worse, and terrible atmosphere with people risking their lives for the sake of Jewish laws and Jewish customs. So there we have this teaching. If we just, I want to stop now because here's a kind of a turning point in the discourse. So here we have this basic teaching of what the creation of the world is about. The creation of the world is in order that the God should have a dwelling in the lower world. So in order to have that, there is a world where God is concealed and where is there's an evil desire and there's a possibility of all kinds of evil and negativity. In that world, there should be people who are aware of the divine. So initially, the central focus is the Jewish people. The Jewish people have the job to communicate to the rest of the world an awareness of the divine. And in fact, there are many people living in the world who believe in God and believe that God created the world and that God watches over each person, because through the Bible, through the Torah, that idea was publicized through Christianity, through Islam. And so millions of people around the world understand, religious people understand that there is a God, there's creation, and God controls all of existence, and that the individual has to live a pure and holy and positive life. And that is something which is there as part of the world. The idea that everyone in the world should keep the seven Noahide laws, and which are communicated by Christianity and Islam in their good sense. And so that is what is the world is supposed to be. But there is the possibility of negativity, and many people fall into different kinds of negativity. Let's just focus on Jewish people. In the Jewish individuals, often, sometimes at least, unfortunately, fall into negative behavior, which is like the folly of the negative kind. But what can redeem that is the sacred folly, the folly which goes beyond rationality and which relates to the divine in a very intense way. And it's through that dedication that the negative aspects can be transformed. And it's in that way that the world can reach its goal, which is the coming of Mashiach, the rebuilding of the temple, the divine presence again revealed in the world. So it's through that that we have gone through about nine or 10 of the original chapters of this discourse, yes, because we've covered it very, very quickly. It's all been packed in very, very concise way. And now we're coming to another step in the process. But at this moment, is there anything that anyone would like to ask?
I have a question.
Yes, Matisio.
I've heard from opponents of Hasidus, or maybe of Chabad Hasidus, that they wonder about that intense focus on the Mitras Tanhuma, Naso 16, I think, if my memory serves me right. It's a very short, they say, obscure Mitras. What would the Chabad answer be to that?
That's a very interesting point. You see, the inward dimension of Torah illuminates the texts and teachings of the Torah. So to Chabad, it's not obscure at all. It's very clear. And it makes perfect sense. When you read the story in the Bible, in the Torah, that you have the divine presence together with Adam and Eve, and then they sin, and they're sent out of the Garden of Eden, which is like the the withdrawal or concealment of the divine presence. And now we have to reveal the divine presence again, and it comes about through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and finally comes Moses and the giving of the Torah and the building of the sanctuary, and the divine presence is again revealed. It's quite clear, even without the Midrash, it's clear that that's the purpose of creation. The purpose of creation is to have that situation that was there in the Garden of Eden, and it was lost, and then it's regained. Even Milton was able to realize. Without the Midrash, and the Midrash expresses it in a very succinct and neat way. So to Chabad, with the hindsight, if you like, hindsight is 2020. What's hindsight? The Hasidic teachings. They tell us what is under the bonnet. People drive a car and the car stops going. Now, why is it stopped going? Some people, they will know, you lift up the bonnet, you see this is wrong, that's wrong, we'll put that right, and then the car will start going again. Hasidism lifts up the bonnet of existence and enables us to see what the Torah actually means. Yes, Rabbi Lou.
To your very eloquent words, we speak about the purpose of creation. I say what's special about Naso 16, as you mentioned, is that in elsewhere where it speaks about the purpose of life, for example, in Pirkei Avot, it will say, prepare yourself in the vestibule for the palace, for the next world. Prepare yourself for this world and the next. Or in other works, it speaks about your purpose on life to reveal the perfection of a human being, how it can be, the godliness of a person. This particular saying of the stages puts it in the context of what God wants, not just where I'm going, so that a person's efforts and the avodah, a person's divine service, is not only something which gives meaning to his own life, but incorporates all of existence and all of history. Everything is part of a certain wider plan. So it might be one line, but so is Shema Yisrael one line.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Lou. That puts it very beautifully, that there's a cosmic purpose. And this line in the Midrash expresses that purpose. And most of the other statements in the Talmud or the Mishnah, like Pirkei Avot, speak about the individual. What do I get out of it? Yes, if a particular individual does a lot of mitzvot, he goes to the Garden of Eden when he passes away. But that's speaking about his reward or her reward. What about the cosmic function? And that's where we need that one line from Naso, Tanchum and Naso. Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing that up. Okay, we're now going to go back to the text, because now we're going to come to what Rabbi Lou was speaking about before, the battle. So now we're on line 8, which is on page 2. On page 7, I think it is. Yeah, page 7, line 8. V'lachein, and therefore, Nikraim b'nei Yisrael, the Jewish people, are called Tzivot Hashem. They are also called, they're called the B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, the Yehudim, the Jews in the book of Esther, but they're also called Tzivot Hashem, the hosts of God. Now, the word hosts, milashon tzava, that's the Hebrew word tzava. And so the plural of tzava is tzvaot. And when it's in the construct, it's tzivot Hashem, the hosts of God. Now, what does this tzava mean? Sheyesh bo shlosha perushim, it's got three interpretations. Tzava, milashon anshei chayil. The word tzava simply as an army, like soldiers. Yisrael heim anshei chayil, the Jewish people are the soldiers, hamamalim u'mashlimim, who complete rotzono shel melech malchei hamlachim hakadosh baruch hu. They complete the will of the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be he. So that's a remarkable way of understanding it. As Rabbi Lu was speaking before, the idea of an army and the Jewish individual being a chayil, a soldier in this army. Incidentally, the word chayil has three letters. And these three letters are sometimes expressed like this. Chet is chassid, which means a spiritual person. Yud is Yerei Shemayim, someone who fears God. And Lamed is Lamdan, a person who studies a lot of Torah. So Chassid, Yerei Shemayim, or Lamdan, a spiritual person who fears God and who studies a lot of Torah. That's what this Chayil is, and that's how one fulfills one's role in the army. That's one meaning of the word Tzava. Then there's another meaning. There's another word also with the same three letters, which means a particular time, a limited defined time. As it says, there's a certain time for man on this world. That is telling us about the style. This is from the book of Job. This is talking about the style of our service. Shekiyum haTorah u'mitzvot, that keeping Torah mitzvot, it's not in heaven. Hu ba'ofen shel itlabshut b'agbalat hazman u'makom lamata. We keep the mitzvot as they are enclosed in the limitation of time and place below. So we keep the mitzvot here below and in this particular moment of time. There's a moment of time, like each day, we have an opportunity. Are we going to learn Torah? Are we going to give tzedakah? Are we going to put on tefillin? Are we going to do other mitzvot that might arise, like lighting candles for Shabbat on Shabbat Friday afternoon? All those things, it's a particular moment of opportunity. And then we have the third explanation of the word tzava. V'tzava l'shon tzivyon v'yofi. Tzava meaning beauty. She'inyan ha'yofi, the concept of beauty, ba al yedei yitkalelut shel kama gvanim, comes through the mingling or the encounter, the contrast between several different colors. And that's the idea that the service of the Jewish people, all of whom are very different from each other, like Hasidim and Mitnagdim and all kinds of other groups, naset al yedei itkalalutam yachad, the fact that they all join together, they are intermingled together, and they keep the Torah together. That is a wonderful thing. That's the beauty. That is the beauty of the achievement of being here in this world and keeping the Torah. Va'al yedei zeh, it's through this, nishlam ha'inyan de'asu li'mikdash, they complete the concept of making for God a sanctuary, v'shachanti b'tocham, and God dwells within them, within each individual, b'chol pratei avodah, in all the details of their service, whether they are learning Torah or doing mitzvot or praying, kafi she'na'asim mitzad b'nei Yisrael lamata, as this is carried out through the Jewish people below. Now this is the conclusion of the first two discourses, and the first two discourses have five chapters in each. So we've just completed the summary of the 10th discourse. Now he begins to go further and discuss what it says in the 11th discourse. Now, Rabbi Lu already gave over a little summary, a very valuable summary of the 11th discourse, that there's a kind of battle. And that battle is like a battle. It's the battle to reveal the divine in the world in a proper way. And it's a battle where there are forces of darkness, and those forces of darkness can be extremely negative. There's the Holocaust, there's many other things, many other negative things. And there is the pressure of modernity, the pressure of secularization, a pressure that people should abandon their heritage, God forbid. And there is this battle. And each person, each Jew, and each human being indeed is involved in this battle. And so the idea, as Rabbi Lu spelled out, that there are different levels of battle. There's a battle which is simply a battle in order to defend a certain piece of territory or to conquer a certain piece of territory. Or there's a battle right against the king himself and the whole idea of the essence of his kingship. And therefore, for this second kind of battle, the king takes the treasures which have been stored for generations, which have been hidden from people's view, and now he takes those treasures and he reveals them. And the beautiful, for the sake of the battle. And that is, Rabbi Lu put a very beautiful explanation of what that treasure is. It is the profound secrets of the Torah, which are now being revealed through teachings like this, so that every human being, and particularly us now at this moment, we are able to take this teaching in order to help us in that battle that each one of us faces every day of our lives in one way or the other. Even the battle to be joyful when we are often surrounded by problematic issues, that itself is a conquest that we should be able to achieve. Now, so here we are in section Bet. So in other words, section Aleph of the discourse went through the first 10 chapters. And now in section Bet, section 2, we are now looking at this chapter 12 of the original discourse, right? So there's chapter 12 in this volume, which I actually translated into English. And we're going to learn bit by bit what this chapter 12 says. Umamshech levaya. Now it continues to explain. In chapter 12, which corresponds to this 12th year of the fourth cycle, details about the treasure above, which is being squandered for the sake of the war, the battle, in order that the king, which means here the king of kings, God, God's rule should be established and visible in the world. We live in a world which is ruled by God, but God is hidden, and God's rule is also hidden, and for many people. And so we live in a world of possibility that the king should be revealed in the right way. So, vehine, and behold, he's quoting here from the original discourse, lahavin in yan ha'otza lemaila, in order to understand the idea of this supernal treasure. What is this treasure? Va'inyan bezeh, what this means is, at first sight, we can't understand. How can you talk about a treasure above? Which is being compared to a treasure house that the king has and the king doesn't want to open it up. He doesn't want to use it for ordinary things. Because they're Jalavitim, he cares about this treasure. Lioto kolel gam kol ma she'nesaf v'nikbatz midorot shelifnei zeh, like a very beautiful narrative that the king has conquered many places and acquired many treasures, and he's collected these treasures. And that's something more precious than anything of the ordinary everyday needs of the king. How can you compare this with God? It's not understood. How can we say, speaking about above, about the divine, that there's something that the king needs, and nonetheless, for that, one doesn't open the treasure, and the treasure remains hidden and concealed. Only when there's a battle, and we have to achieve this battle, the victory for the sake of the king. How does that fit above this whole image? How do we see this in terms of the divine? I'm skipping a few lines. About this, it explains. In order to understand this treasure above, it's according to, we will understand this idea of this supernal treasure through a brief phrase, a line, just over a line from the Tikkuni Zohar. Now, there are several sections of the Zohar. There's the Zohar, which runs on the five books of Moses, and you can open it up, Bereshit, Shemot, and each Sedra of the week, you've got a section which is in the Zohar. That's the regular Zohar. Then there's another volume called Tikkuni Zohar. The Tikkuni Zohar works on the word Bereshit, and it looks, which means in the beginning, and it looks at many different combinations of this word, 70 combinations of this word. And each combination is a tikkun. It's a special refinement. The tikkun means to put something right. And so each of the tikkunim of this Tikkuni Zohar is something very, very special. It's a kind of deeper dimension even than the ordinary Zohar. And there it says this statement, and this statement is very powerful if we can understand it. And this is what I mean by something advanced. Here it is on line 25. Or Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite, Lemala ad Ein Kets, goes higher and higher and higher without end. Ulamata, and it goes below, lower and lower, ad ein tachlit, also without any conclusion. In other words, it goes higher and higher and higher, and it goes lower and lower and lower. Now that's a very powerful statement. You know, when we study this kind of text, we can become very familiar with different terms. I remember, you see, there's Rabbi Lu. Rabbi Lu was the first person I met actually in the Chabad group. He had become a student counselor, and I was his first student. I'm very proud of that. But I also encountered another man called Rabbi Nachman Sudat, Alav Shalom, Libor Mechaim Lechaim. He passed away. Now, I remember Rabbi Sudak, he was once commenting, you know, we were talking about these Kabbalistic terms, Atzilut, for example. The Atzilut is the highest of the four worlds. There's the world of action at this level, then the world of formation, then the world of creation, then the world of emanation. And the world of emanation, the Hebrew word for it is atzilut. And Rabbi Sudak said, you say that word so easily. do you know that Rabbi Schneur Zalman, the founder of Chabad, couldn't say that word? It meant too much to him. You can say it because it doesn't mean very much to you, emanation, this, that. But for Rabbi Schneur Zalman, he couldn't say it. And even when he wrote it, he wouldn't write the whole word. He would write Aleph, Tzadik, Yud, and then like a dash, an apostrophe to say that you have to finish the word yourself. It was too intense for him. So here now we're looking at this phrase from the Tikkun Ezor, the radiance of the Ein Sof. Now Ein Sof, I translate infinite. It's without end. The radiance of the infinite, of the without end, of the Ein Sof, goes higher and higher and higher and higher and higher without end. And it also goes lower and lower and lower without end. If we took these words seriously, as they say in English, we'd be stoned out of our minds. it's too much, yes, as people say. It's a very intense thing. You know, don't drive or operate machinery when contemplating the radiance of the infinite going higher and higher and lower and lower. It's just out of this world.
Sorry.
Yes, Rivka.
How could it go without end when it goes downward? And tachlit means really, I think tachlit means aim or purpose, or without purpose. Without.
I think the without tachlit, without end. Well, I wonder, you see, Rabbi Lud, you see what Rivka's asking? What does it mean without end going down? She can understand without end going up because there's no limit upwards. But what about without end going down?
This actual discourse will explain that the power of infinity is expressed even in the physical world. Not only in potential, but in practical. And that is a manifestation of the combination between the highest and the lowest. So it's saying it goes to the world without any ending. You don't say that it goes to the penultimate, that the deepest essence of God can be revealed but the truth is it cannot be revealed anywhere else except on this physical world. And that's what this maimer goes on to describe.
Okay.
B'li tachlis means to no end. Tachlis is from the expression of hakol. Hal means to end. So it goes, the highest essence of God shines in this world. In other words, there's no limit to it.
I think Rivka's asking, what sense is there no limit? Because you could say when it gets to this world, so that's the end. What's lower than this world?
No, the remarkable thing, the fantastic thing, is that it is revealed specifically in this world. Not until it gets to the lowest world, it says, in that world, for that power to be revealed, the most mind-blowing concept. Because it means that the essence of godliness expressed in this physical world.
I think an important aspect to it between the lines is that we have to realize just how low this world is. And we don't realize that. We live in a kind of cocoon because the negative possibilities that are here in this world themselves are without end. And nonetheless, the divine dwells in this world at the lowest level.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
In order, this is the only world, this is the only level of existence where there is the possibility of choice. And only with human beings, because animals, they just follow instinct. Animals follow instinct. And in order to have freedom of choice, there has to be evil. To be able to be good, it's only if it comes as a choice when there was a choice of evil. So there's a level in which God says, it doesn't make any difference to me whether you did the mitzvah or you didn't do the mitzvah, whether you did the sin or not, because that is the level of the will of God, that there should be free choice. And if there weren't that level, then there wouldn't be any free choice. There wouldn't be any possibility of evil. But that is the outer will. Will which is above all the sefirot, all of the intellectual levels. But the inner will, ultimate will, that we should choose by choice. So all of that is explained here in this maimer as a manifestation of this physical world, whereby Esav is a brother of Yaakov. God says, I want you to choose. And so that is a manifestation of the deepest will of God that comes down into the world of Adin Tachlis, of a world where a person can choose, as Rabbi Tali just said, where you can choose evil as well.
Thank you.
In that existence, choose good, deepest possible thing that can happen.
Thank you. Pinchas Elio, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, maybe I got the answer, because we say that Ohr and Sof is infinite, but we also saw that the Tzimtzum is infinite and without end. And that means that it's also created a possibility there will be no Ohr and Sof at all, because it will so be so contracted. The Tzimtzum will be so manifest that there is nothing else than the Sitracha.
Ah, how lovely.
But I think that's what Rabbi Lou said. We had that opportunity, unfortunately.
That's a very beautiful statement, because it gives an opportunity to understand a famous argument in Jewish tradition, in the Kabbalah. You see, Tzimtzum is the contraction. It's a contraction. The way that the Rabbi Isaac Luria explains, originally the radiance of God filled everything. Hold on 1 second.
You think don't off the cooker, and for heaven's sake, microwave the pasta.
Yeah.
And try and eat it.
Right.
The
right. Yeah.
Good night, Father.
Good night. So there is the, everything is filled with the radiance of the divine. And then it says there's a tzimtzum, that God contracted the radiance in order to make a space to create the world, right? That's on the first couple of pages of the Tree of Life, Eitz Chaim, by Reb Chaim Vital, explaining the teachings of Rabbi Isaac Luria. So there came a great argument among the Kabbalists. Does it mean tzimtzum literally? In which case, contracting, that means the light is not there, it's contracted away. Or is it only a metaphorical way of speaking? And in fact, the light of the radiance of the infinite is everywhere, whatever happens, despite the tzimtzum. So one of the ways of understanding the difference between the Hasidim and the opponents of the Hasidim is the opponents of the Hasidim took tzimtzum literally. And they said that there is a realm where the radiance of the divine is not there because of the tzimtzum. So there's only darkness, only sitra achra, as you put it, only the other side, the negative side. But for the Hasidim, especially the Chabad Hasidim, who study this kind of material, they say, no, no. The tzimtzum is lo kipshuto, it's not literally, it's metaphorical. And of course, the divine radiance pervades everywhere. Leit ata panui mine, it says in the Zohar. There is no spot where the divine radiance doesn't reach. And in fact, this discourse itself ends with the idea that despite the tzimtzum, the radiance flows with infinite worlds which are created by the radiance. So it's very interesting that you mentioned.
It is, and it's very beautiful, but I feel a contraction because I see an elephant. I don't see the Hebrew letters Pei Yud Lamed. I see an elephant. I don't say Pei Yud Lamed.
But Pinchas Eliyahu.
It's so contracted. I can't see Pei Yud Lamed.
But that's just the difference of the eyes.
I don't know. Okay.
Rabbi Rashab, the father of Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak, Rabbi Shalom Dogber, who he passed away in 1920. But at one time he was with a gathering of his Hasidim, and in a Hasidic gathering, there was vodka and there was cake and there was fish, there was herring. And the Rebbe Rashab said, "You think this is fish? This is the word of God saying, du soll sein fish, you should be fish." So we see fish. We see an elephant, but he would see the word of God.
On my own.
Okay. All right, let's go back into it. We're not going to be able, it's a very long distance, a very long discourse.
Can I ask you something?
Yes, Eve.
Maybe I missed it. So we know it's there, and we know we're supposed to connect, and we know we're supposed to do mitzvot. So how do we, I mean, you can't make it happen.
Make what happen?
The connection.
When you...
You can't make yourself see it. You can know about it, you can be told, but can you... actually experience it?
Look, I would suggest like this, Eve. You walk into a room and it's dark and you turn on the light. Now, when you turn on the light, you don't, what you're actually doing is you are connecting the light bulb in your room with the generator in the power station somewhere in your city or near your city. And by pressing that switch, you are making a connection at that moment. You right. don't feel it at all. You're just...
Where is the switch?
Yeah, you just...
Where is the switch?
Well, the switch is the mitzvah.
Oh, okay.
The switch is the mitzvah. If we felt the energy, if the insulation was torn, and we felt the energy going through, it would have a terrible effect. We would get a serious electric shock, Chas v'Shalom. It would be a bad thing.
Okay. So for you, it says the mitzvah. But I mean, you could do a mitzvah and not get the electric shock or any kind of shock. You can just do the mitzvah with good intentions, but you can... So it's a gift.
What's the last word you said?
It has to be a gift then.
A gift? Every single one of us can do a mitzvah. The question of how the mitzvah makes us tingle, if you like, within limits, that it doesn't make us tingle too much, because otherwise we collapse on the floor. So that depends on the insight of the person using the Hopkins, Gerald Manley Hopkins, yes, the inside of the person, the inscape, looking the inner, which we do through studying Hasidic teachings and other kinds of sensitivity poetry might express, and being able to be sensitive to the inscape of existence, which every human being in the world can be sensitive to. It's not limited to the Jewish people.
Yeah, okay. And that was very helpful.
Okay.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So now there is. So it speaks here about the way when we say the word Or Ein Sof, it's that it is the radiance of the Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite. But another way of understanding it, that the radiance itself is Ein Sof, the Or, the radiance which is Ein Sof. And we're talking about the way that this radiance is itself infinite, and it goes beyond and beyond. And it links, one second, there's, I'm looking for a particular point, which, but so this radiance, which goes, one second. It's the radiance has the quality of the luminary, which generates that radiance. And there are different kinds of flow which come from that luminary. And one second, I'm looking for a particular statement, which is, it's a quotation. Do you remember where it is, Rabbi Lou? It is a quotation. I think it's another quotation from the Zohar, a very powerful quotation.
Which quotation?
It says about the light. Ah, here we are. So here we're talking about the highest level, higher and higher. And it explains this with a passage from the Zohar, a very deep part of the Zohar called the Idra Zuta. And the Zohar says like this. Now this to me, if the previous phrase was very deep, you get stolen out of your mind. Look at this phrase. Kahai Botsina, it's in Aramaic. Kahai Botsina, it's like a candle. The it pashet l'chol stav eva. It spreads out, the radiance spreads out to every side, everywhere. But when you look in order to know what it is, what it's shining, you will find nothing except that candle. There's only that candle. It's like Ein Od Milvador. There's nothing apart from God. And that's really what it means. The radiance higher and higher and higher, that all the millions of universes and everything, that's just the physical world. And then we enter the spiritual realm, and higher and higher and higher. There's just that Hashem Echad, God is one. That's just that candle. And that is what shines higher and higher. And then, as Rabbi Lou says, but we've reached the end of our time, that is what happens. That is, that intensity is revealed here in this world, in this low world where everything negative, unfortunately, is possible. There was the Holocaust. There were all kinds of other horrific tragedies of all different kinds. And living in this world, here is where that light of the essence is able to be revealed through our struggle, trying to keep Torah and mitzvah in a world where we are challenged in all kinds of different ways, but with joyfulness, with simcha, we will be able to do that and reveal the divine in such a way that in the whole world, for every human being, and even the animals, the infinite oneness of God will be revealed, and the world will be filled with knowledge of God, like the waters covered the sea. Rabbi Lou, this is only a tiny attempt at summarizing this very lengthy discourse. Would you want to add any other point?
I want to say it was a beautiful attempt and a successful one.
It's an amazing discourse. Now, next week, hopefully, we'll look at another discourse also of this from the second cycle. This discourse we learn is from the first cycle. Then there's the discourse from the second cycle. And we are now in the fourth cycle. So, so we will be exploring this concept, but in another discourse next week, hopefully. But Mashiach may come first. And in that case, we will hear a new discourse in the fourth cycle.
Is it too late to go into a question?
Okay, Julian.
Thank you. Going back to the